Patty and tell them, I've met someone, and, well, I'm sort of moving forward with a relationship with her. I brace, holding my breath, not knowing how they will react. Hurt, sadness, anger. Instead, I get smiles. Serious fucking smiles from them both, full of pure elation for me. My heart swells. I genuinely didn't think it was possible to love these people more than I already did. It means they trust MJ's memory will always burn bright with me, and that I loved her as fiercely as I could while she was on this earth. It says they never had any expectations for me to be lonely or hold her up on a pedestal, never to be replaced in my affections. I let out a sigh, along with a nervous laugh. Gotta tell you, I was nervous about telling you that. Patty leans forward, clearly excited.
You must tell us all about her. Don't leave out a single detail about how you met and fell in love.
I flinch when she drops the L word so casually, yet it's not from an adverse feeling. Just more surprising that Patty would assume I am in love with Nora. It makes me think, am I? I pull out my phone, then bring it out of sleep mode. Let me show you a picture of her. Nora's face comes up on my home screen. I'd replaced MJ's picture with Nora's on the flight here to Dallas. It seemed way more symbolic than it really needed to be, but I have my safety net. MJ's pictures will always stay on my phone so I can look at them and never forget what she was to me.
Oh, she's beautiful.
Patty sighs, tilts her head, and studies Nora's face. It's a great face.
Would MJ have liked her?
Charles asks, and that gives me a little stab of pain deep in my gut. My eyes rise to meet his. Yeah, she would have really liked her.
That's all I need to know,
he says, then raises his beer in the air for a silent toast to both MJ and Nora. Laughing, I settle back into my chair, placing my phone on the table. So, Nora was actually my therapist to start.
Oh,
Patty squeals, clapping her hands.
A forbidden love story.
Smirking, I lift my chin. Yeah, you could say that. Chapter 29, Tacker. Twisting my wrists, I check my watch as my fingers on my other hand impatiently drum on the desktop. Management called an emergency team meeting, and it's interfering in my time with Nora. I'd been on my way out the door to her place when the call came in, directing everyone to the team auditorium at the arena where we normally hold our meetings and game film reviews. I'd just flown in from our Texas road trip, Dallas, then Houston, and we were slated to have the entire day off today. After that is our last home game of the regular season. Next week, the playoffs start. So today was the perfect opportunity to spend time with Nora, who I had been missing greatly these last several days I was gone. Our plan was to attempt that horseback ride that got waylaid when Raul got sick. Once we finished that, if I had any say in it, part of the day would be spent in bed. Perhaps we'd go out to dinner, or maybe we'd order in and eat in bed. Regardless, I wanted the full day and evening with Nora. But with every second that ticks by, said time is being wasted.
You want to go hit some golf balls today?
Aaron asks, nudging me in the arm. He's playing some game on his phone while we wait, slouched in his chair with his long legs spread out in front of him. His eyes are bloodshot, and his hair is sticking up all over the place. It tells me he had a late, probably drunken time out last night. He'd probably been woken up by the call to come into the arena for a meeting. Can't, I reply, checking my watch one more time. A total of 20 seconds has passed since the last check.
Going to hang with Nora today.
Of course you are,
he mutters. Guilt nags as I study his face. I'm sorry, man. I know I owe you some time. Aaron grins ruefully.
As much as I wish you'd revert back to the party animal I once loved and adored when we played together in Dallas long before you met MJ, honestly, dude, I'm glad you've found Nora. I'd rather you do what makes you happiest, even if it's not hanging out with my lame ass.
Your ass is not lame, I assure him, which causes the players sitting in the row in front of us to glance back at us with raised eyebrows. Ignoring them, I add, but seriously, let's plan something right now. How about Sunday, after practice? We'll go shoot 18 and relax. Truth is, I have to plan in advance now. That's because, in my mind, all my free time belongs to Nora. Not because she's demanded it, because I want it that way. Doesn't mean I don't want friendships and to hang with my buds, but if it isn't planned in advance, they can rest assured I've already got something going with Nora.
Yeah, sure, he replies as his attention returns to his game. We can do that.
My mind already starts calculating whether I can squeeze in time with Nora that day. If we play a round of golf starting around 11 a.m. after practice, I could head to the ranch and pick Nora up for dinner. That would probably work. Before I can even chastise myself for being so pathetic and trying to slot as much time with this woman as I can possibly cram in, the door to the room opens and all the chatter dies down. Coach Perrone enters, followed by the rest of the coaching staff. Next is Christian Rutherford. I can't say I'm surprised to see Dominic Carlson following them in. Since he lives in Los Angeles, no one expected Dominic to spend much time with our team. He owns a professional basketball team there that's always done very well. It's probably his most lucrative venture. But he's proved us wrong over and over again this season, popping into several home and away games to cheer us on, and even showing up at non-game events. He crashed the rookie party this year, which, to my knowledge, has never been done by any team owner ever. And when he came to Nora's ranch to volunteer, he made it clear he's more than just the man who owns us. Dominic walks straight to the podium, making it obvious he's the one who called this meeting. His voice is booming enough that he doesn't need the microphone attached there.
I appreciate you all coming in on such short notice, he says as he addresses the crowd of players. I was actually headed to New York, but I decided to make a stop here first, so truly, thank you for your indulgence of me.
Of course he did. He has all kinds of private planes at his disposal. He even lent one to Bishop so he could chase Brooke across the country once. Leaning a forearm on the podium, he flashes us a grin.
You may have noticed already, but I'm a bit different than the other team owners, a bit nosier, so to speak.
There's a smattering of laughter across the room, but I notice that Dax's jaw locks. Dominic has definitely been nosy where Dax's sister Willow is concerned. The grin falls away as Dominic's eyes turn sober.
I'm never going to be the type of owner who just sits back and counts the money you make me. I want you all to succeed. To do that, you have to be happy, well-adjusted, and fulfilled. For those reasons, I sometimes nose around in your business to make sure I can help that happen. I hope you're used to that by now.
There's more laughter, and Eric has a genuinely fond expression on his face right now, as does Bishop. Dominic had once helped Blue with legal troubles over her parents' estate.
I'm not going to sit up here and give you a motivational speech about how we can win the cup this year. I don't need to reiterate how well we're doing or that we've created history by having the best record of any expansion team entering the league.
Fucking right on!
Someone calls from the back. There are a few hoots and a lot more laughter. Dominic joins in. When things settle, he continues.
The hockey news is focused on the Cold Fury right now. Sure, people are interested in us, but they're more interested in seeing the Cold Fury win 3 championships in a row.
Now there's only silence.
I say, fuck that,
Dominic growls, banging his fist on the podium and straightening his body.
I'm here to tell you they can't do it, because we are the fucking Arizona Vengeance, and we're directly in their way. They'll never make it through us, can't go around us. The only thing they can hope to do is get trampled by us. That's all any team can hope for. And, well, I just wanted to stop by and tell you, with the playoffs starting next week, I can't wait to see you start your path to victory.
There's a thunderous boom of applause as we rise for a standing ovation. He said he wasn't trying to motivate us, but fuck if he didn't do just that. We clap, stomp, and holler. Dominic holds one hand up, an acknowledgement he appreciates our response. With one last smile, he pivots on his heel before marching out of the room. Christ, that guy has class. Coach Perrone moves to the podium. He knows he can't compete, so he merely spends a few moments reminding us of the practice schedule for the next week. When he's done, we all start to file out. Dominic's name is on everyone's lips. At the end of the row, Aaron and I meet up with Dax and Bishop.
You guys want to hang?
Dax asks as we follow him down the aisle toward the door.
I'm in,
Bishop says.
Me too,
Aaron adds. I'm out, I tell the group. Got plans with Nora. No one gives me shit about it, but I don't miss the smiles on their faces. At the door, we wait for the logjam of guys to shuffle through. Just as Dax is exiting ahead of me, I spot Dominic. His eyes lock on Dax, who I can hear audibly groan at the attention. Dominic makes absolutely no bones about his interest in Dax's sister.
Is Willow going to be coming to any of the playoff games?
Why don't you ask her yourself? Dax mutters.
I would, but she's still not answering my texts or calls.
Dominic says with a laugh, not sounding put out in the slightest. If anything, I think he's enjoying her lack of interest in him.
Well, there you go,
Dax replies, stalking right by Dominic. Bold move to fuck with a man who has the ability to fire him from the team, but Dax is the type who would never be cowed by such a thing. He's going to protect his sister at all costs. Dominic's eyes, filled with amusement, follow Dax a moment before settling on me. Lifting his chin in greeting, he asks,
"Got a minute to talk?"
"Sure," I reply, not able to stop my gaze from dropping to my watch to calculate how much more time I'll be missing out on with Nora. Dominic leads me down the hall from the auditorium, away from the other players for semi-privacy. He leans against the wall, crosses his arms over his chest, and asks,
"Just wanted to check in, see how things are going."
"Good," I say with no hesitation. "Really good, actually." Dominic nods, as if this is not news to him.
"Dr. Dumfries has been keeping me updated. He's extremely impressed with the work you've done on yourself."
"He's pretty easy to talk to," I admit. Not as easy as Nora, but who is?
"He's told me that you're doing so well, he could discharge you if you want. At the very least, I don't think he needs to report to me anymore."
That catches me by surprise, since Dumfries hasn't discussed that with me. "I think I'll stick with him a little longer," I say hesitantly. While I've felt the best I have in an awfully long time, I'm also aware this could all be precarious. I'll never take my current state of happiness for granted. In fact, I sometimes expect sudden grief to overwhelm me. Knock on wood.
"Oh, and I think you can drink again if you want," Dominic says. "Dumfries says alcohol isn't really an issue."
"That's because I was never a big drinker to begin with," I say with a smile. "But
Thank you for removing that restriction. Dominic nods, then starts to turn away, but he hesitates, examining me with curious eyes.
Nora was the game changer, wasn't she?
I'm not surprised he knows about Nora. I never gave him any explanation as to why I went back to Dumfries, but my dating Nora isn't a secret. I've told the entire team, so it's only natural that word filtered back to Dominic. Wouldn't be standing here talking to you like this if it wasn't for her, I say. He appraises me, eyes boring deep, seemingly satisfied with my proclamation. He nods.
I'm happy for you then.
Dominic sticks his hand out, and I take it.
I expect great things from you during the playoffs.
You'll get them, I assure him. Dominic nods, giving a hard squeeze to my hand before releasing it. When he turns away, I realize I haven't told him something incredibly important. Dominic, I call. He stops, tilting his head in question. Thank you for believing in me, for giving me a chance to stay on this team, and most importantly, for making me get counseling. Otherwise, I wouldn't have met Nora. He nods again. One other thing, I say. Dominic waits patiently. Willow's flying back this weekend. Dax says she's going to stay with him and Reagan for a few weeks. Eyes flaring, his lips curl with pure carnal delight.
Thank you,
he says with almost a slight bow. If anyone asks, you're totally my favorite player on the team. I grin, not feeling the slightest bit sorry in revealing that info. Dominic was going to figure it out when Willow came to the games and vengeance events anyway. Yeah, he's a good dude in my opinion. I watch him for a moment as he walks away before I'm jolted back to reality. Nora, she's waiting on me and I'm more than ready to see her.
Chapter 30. Nora.
That's good, Emily, I call as I watch the 9-year-old take Starlight around the arena in a perfect canter. She's been taking lessons from us for only about 4 months, but she's such a natural. Switching my attention to Raoul, where he's standing on the other side of the fence, I study him. He has his forearms resting on the top post, one booted foot on the lower rung. He smiles, proud to see Emily's progress. The little girl works with both Raoul and me, depending on availability, since so much of my time these days is devoted to my counseling patients. But I'm light on that today, and I love just being able to teach kids to ride. Brings back so many fond memories of Raoul teaching me everything I know about horses and how to sit them properly, how to love them. So much of what I am today is because of the man on the other side of the paddock fence. I glance down at my watch. There's still a lot I have to do today, and Emily's lesson will be done soon. Her mom is waiting for her in the car, preferring to talk on the phone rather than watch. After this lesson, I'm going to help Raoul rearrange our storage room to make room for a feed delivery. Then I have to tackle the chicken coops to clean them out. Normally Raoul does that, but I've sort of been babying him since his illness last week. I've had to be surreptitious doing this, though, so he doesn't catch on. For example, I can't just go to him and say, Raoul, I'm going to clean the coops today rather than you because I'm afraid for your health. If I did that, he'd be beyond pissed. So this morning I'd instead said, Raoul, can you take my 10 and 11 a.m. lessons today? They're both having issues with saddle positioning. No matter how much I work with them on it, I can't get it corrected. I know I'm missing something. I truly have no clue if he bought the lie, but he told me no problem. I didn't bother telling him I'd do the coops instead, preferring to just knock it out now and tell him that I felt useless doing nothing later. At any rate, after the coops, I'm going to shower, change, and then head into Phoenix. Tacker has an afternoon game, which I'm going to go to, and then after, we have plans to go out to dinner. Correction. We're going out to a fancy dinner. Tacker told me to dress to the nines, which I honestly don't remember the last time I did that. It's not easy dating a professional hockey player. Between his travel and my hectic schedule, having nice dates out has been a near impossibility. Not that I'm complaining. I'm simply happy to be spending any time with Tacker, a man I have come to care so deeply for that I'm worried my heart has been irrevocably stolen. "Okay, Emily," I instruct in a clear voice. "Bring it down to a trot." When she complies, I let her do one loop around. "Over to Raoul," I state, and she perfectly slows the horse to a walk, guiding it to the gate where Raoul has moved to meet her. I walk that way as well, letting him help her dismount. Raoul will change up horses before the next lesson to give Starlight a rest. Emily runs over to me, then throws her arms around my waist. "That was a great lesson. My canter's getting good, isn't it?" "So good," I praise, giving her a squeeze in return. She beams, which solidifies my hunch that she doesn't get a lot of emotional support or comfort at home. Her parents seem distinctly uninterested in her. It makes me appreciate Helen all the more. Even though it wasn't necessary, Helen came to all my lessons with Raoul for probably that entire first year. After we'd developed a close friendship with him, she'd often drop me off for lessons and Raoul would give me a lift home. But even after I'd been riding for years, Helen would often come just to watch me. She'd occasionally join me, but she wasn't much of a horsewoman. Much the same way I can just tell Tacker will never be much of a horseman. Sure, he's gotten comfortable with them, to the extent he can maneuver them in and out of stalls, and he's not intimidated by their size. But he's never going to feel fully comfortable in the saddle. I can just tell. We went on a ride yesterday when he made it out to the ranch after an impromptu team meeting. And while he had a good time, we both did, he's just not going to love these animals the way I do. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. We don't have to share all the same passions, not as long as we share some. While Tacker doesn't necessarily love riding, he does love working on this ranch. He loves animals in general. Sometimes I find him simply playing with and loving on the dogs or goats. He also loves hard work and making a difference. He loves helping. And he loves kids. I've seen him interacting with them here, plus the way he is with Billy, and I can just tell deep down, he's a giver. That's his nature. Emily gives me one last squeeze, and I have to jolt away from my thoughts of Tacker. I smile ruefully at my lovesickness. Tacker seems to occupy my thoughts quite a bit each and every day. I'm okay with that, too. "See you next week," I tell Emily, watching as she runs out of the arena and jumps into her mom's car. When they're halfway down the drive, I turn to see Raoul leading Starlight to the barn. "You good switching the horses out?" He doesn't even look over his shoulder, just throws a hand up in acknowledgement.
"Got it."
"Okay, I'm off to clean the coops," I call as I move out of the paddock. Another thought strikes me about the next lesson coming up, and I pivot to ask him a question. My heart leaps into my throat. Raoul is on the ground. Just that fast, he was talking to me and walking Starlight, and in the next second, he was down. "Raoul!" I scream, taking off running toward him. Starlight stands placidly beside him, just a little too close, so I put a hand to her chest and the other to her lead, encouraging her to back up. She's such an obedient horse that she does so easily. Then she's forgotten as I scramble to Raoul. I drop to my knees in the dirt beside him. He's on his side, his hat having been knocked off in the fall, but his face is turned downward and hidden by his arm. "Raoul!" I call, giving him a slight shake of the shoulder. I don't get a single sound back from him. Panic seizes me, and tears fill my eyes. My initial thoughts are that I can't handle him dying. I'm not ready for this. And just as quickly, a measure of calm sneaks in as I realize, I don't even know if he's dead. "Fuck," I mutter, quickly but gently rolling him to his back. He's completely unconscious, and my training kicks in. Since I deal with so many children on the ranch, I'm certified in CPR. I even have a portable defibrillator in my office. When I place shaky fingers on his neck, I can't detect a pulse. Oh God, Raul, I moan before grabbing my phone from my back pocket. I quickly dial 911 and put the phone to my ear, holding it in place with a hunched shoulder. As it's ringing, I place one hand over the other, lace my fingers, and begin compressions on Raul's chest.
911, what's your emergency?
A man's voice comes across the phone. My voice is shaking. Yes, I'm at 4811 Goose Camp Road. It's Sherem Ranch. My foreman has collapsed and I can't find a pulse. I need an ambulance. The man's voice is cool and collected, sounding softly reassuring.
Okay, I'm dispatching paramedics to you right now. Do you know how to perform CPR?
Yes, and I'm doing compressions right now, I say. But then I get really panicky and fuck, I don't even know how many I've done. It's 30, right? I do 30 and then two breaths.
Ma'am, the man says smoothly. It's fine. You can just continue to do compressions, no more than 100 per minute until paramedics arrive.
I have a defibrillator in my office, I say, my voice squeaking with nerves.
Is there anyone who can get that for you?
He asks. No, I reply, and then a sob comes out. I'm here by myself.
Okay, you just stay with him and continue compressions. I'm showing the paramedics are just about 4 minutes out right now.
4 minutes? That's an eternity. I want to check for a pulse, but I'm afraid to stop what I'm doing. I can't tell if he's breathing while I'm doing compressions. I want to break down and cry, but I can't, because his life depends on me right now. Turns out, watching an unconscious Raul for 4 minutes while waiting for medical help to arrive is perhaps one of the most excruciating things I've ever been through. Not nearly as traumatic as watching my family gunned down or my sister raped, but it's third in line. Even watching Helen die wasn't this horrific, because I'd been prepared. She was in pain and it was a relief. It was also very peaceful. If Raul dies under my hands in the dirt, with starlight watching over my shoulder, I'm not sure I'll ever be able to get over it. Finally, I hear the beautiful wail of the siren. It gets louder and louder. Soon, the ambulance is bumping down my gravel road. Thankfully, Raul fell in a spot where they can easily see us as they approach. They pull in close, two young men jumping out with gear bags. I don't stop compressing his chest until they tell me to move aside. When I do, I watch helplessly as they work on him.
I have a pulse, I hear one say.
The flood of relief at hearing those words is so great, my legs give way. I sag to the ground, right at Starlight's hooves. I watch for a few moments as they work on Raul. They're efficient, managing to hook him up to monitors, get an IV rolling, and put him on a gurney in less than 2 minutes.
Ma'am, we're going to take him to Lake General,
one says, as they start moving him toward the back of the ambulance. I blink, trying to focus.
Would you like to ride with us or meet us there?
Shit, I mutter as I scramble to my feet. I want to ride with you. Let me just put Starlight up. I'll have to call and cancel the next two appointments, and I'm going to need to get someone to come feed the horses later. I jog to the barn, Starlight trotting easily behind me. In moments, I have her released into her stall and the door shut before I'm sprinting back to the ambulance. The side door is open and I climb in. One of the paramedics directs me to a bench beside Raul where I can sit. I sort of thought they'd have me ride up front, but I'm grateful to be back here with him. I grab his hand, relishing the fact it's still warm. It's only after the ambulance is on its way that I pull my phone out. I send a quick text to the two appointments I have coming to cancel. Then I call Tacker. He answers on the second ring.
What's up, you gorgeous, smoking hot woman, you?
Tacker, I say, my voice cracking. He's on instant high alert.
What's wrong?
It's Raul, I say, sucking in breath through my nose in an effort not to break down.
Slowly, I let it out. He collapsed. We're in an ambulance headed to Lake General Hospital.
Jesus.
He groans, and I can feel the fear and pain in his voice. He's come to care so much for Raoul.
I'll head that way now and meet you there.
Okay, I say, my voice so small I'm surprised he hears it. But he does, and his is strong in response.
He's a tough old man. He'll be fine. I promise.
I don't know how he could possibly know that. For now, though, I choose to believe him. You're right, I finally say into the phone. He'll be fine. When Tacker hangs up, I start to pray we're both right.
Chapter 31, Tacker. I told her Raoul would be fine, and I'm kicking myself for saying it. It's a promise to her that I'm not sure I can uphold because it's completely out of my control. All that I keep telling myself over and over again as I correct my course to the hospital is that Raoul is indeed tough and in general good health. Whatever made him collapse is nothing but a speed bump which he can overcome. I hope. I also start to pray as I drive, something I haven't bothered doing in an awfully long time because I had convinced myself that God didn't care. Funny how quickly I can lapse back into calling on him for help. But I'm not asking for me, I'm asking for Nora. She doesn't deserve any more sadness. While I logically know Raoul will die one day, it can't be today. Things are just going too good for Nora these days, and for me as well, that I selfishly don't want to have to deal with grief again. My GPS effortlessly manages to put me at the hospital within 25 minutes of Nora's call. I head into the emergency room, the sliding glass doors whooshing behind me. I'm slowed down by the hospital's diligence to security. Once I make it through a metal detector, I scan the lobby. Nearly every chair is filled with the sick and injured that are waiting to be seen. I can't find Nora, so I go to the admissions desk. A helpful-looking girl smiles at me. Her eyes flare with recognition. Thankfully, she doesn't make a big deal about who I am. I'm sure she can tell by the expression on my face that I've got other things on my mind.
Can I help you?
She asks. My friend was brought in by ambulance, Raoul Vargas, I say. I'm also looking for my other friend who rode along with him, Nora Wayne.
Just a minute,
she replies as she starts tapping away on her computer. However, before she can even look back up, a set of doors to my right opens and Nora comes through. Her arms are crossed over her stomach, her eyes somewhat blank. My heart sinks, assuming the worst, but then she sees me. Relief causes that iron mask to crumble. She stumbles right into me, burying her face into my chest. I hold her for a moment, my heart hammering with fear as to what she might say about Raoul. Finally, she pulls her head back so she can see me.
They're working on him now. They told me to wait out here until they get him stabilized.
What happened?
I don't know.
She practically moans, sounding helpless.
One minute he was fine, the next he was on the ground. I couldn't find a pulse, so I started CPR. It was awful.
At this point, she starts sobbing, so I lead her over into a corner of the lobby where there aren't any chairs, only a huge potted plant, but at least it affords us a little privacy. Simply holding Nora, I let her cry. Every tear soaking into my shirt causes my chest to ache more and more. When she calms down, she sounds so lost and defeated.
The paramedics found a pulse when they got there. Who knows, maybe it was there all along and I just didn't feel it at first in my panic. But he's alive. They said it looks like something to do with his heart. Honestly, I probably only heard half of what they were telling me.
He's in good hands now,
I say as I rub her back. Nora pulls away with wild eyes tinged with red.
I can't do this. I'm not ready to lose him. I seriously am at my limit, Tacker. I can't lose anyone else.
I'm short on words of reassurance. I have no clue what his condition is or how precarious. All I do know is that her pain is my pain. Her fear is palpable, and the threat of impending grief makes my legs weak. Seeing Nora like this, so unsure of herself and almost paralyzed with fear, brings me right back to that plane crash, sitting there trapped by wreckage while feeling utterly helpless. I watched MJ in pain, crippled with fear, and there wasn't a damn thing I could do. Seeing Nora like this, hearing the agony in her voice and knowing how much she's already hurting, it slices through me as sharply as it did when it was MJ looking to me for all the answers on how to make it better. It should be apples and oranges, but it's not. It's two women I love who are hurting, and I don't know what else to do but take that upon my shoulders. Admittedly, there's a moment when I think to myself, yeah, not sure I can handle this either. There's something to be said about closing myself off from the world. Sure, I'd be isolated and lonely, but my capacity for pain would be largely diminished. As I study Nora right now, her hurt causing me hurt, I have to wonder why I want this. Maybe I don't. Maybe I'm just too sensitive. Maybe I'm broken. Or maybe I just love way too deeply, which makes it my risk to bear. Here this woman stands in front of me, healthy and whole, yet in pain because someone she loves is extremely sick. I can feel every bit of it deep in my bones. And it's not even Nora who is at risk of dying. It's just her sadness I'm feeling, and it hurts as keenly as if I'd lost her. In all the times over the last several weeks when I've compared MJ to Nora and vice versa, it didn't hit me until right this very moment that there is a big difference between the women. And it's that Nora actually has the capacity to hurt me way more than MJ's death ever did. Yeah, it makes me feel like shit to even admit it, but it's true. The bond I've forged with Nora is deeper and more ingrained into my being. Losing her would fuck me up big time. Walk away. It would be safer, easier.
I'm sorry,
Nora says with a sniff as she wipes at her eyes. Pulling out of my embrace, she puts on a brave face.
Didn't mean to fall apart on you there.
Don't be sorry, I say, but it's an automatic response. Nora shakes her head.
You don't need this on you. You've been dealing with enough. You don't need me adding to your problems.
You're not. And then it hits me like a ton of bricks, makes me dizzy with the realization. Nora is not and never could be a problem to me, nor a burden. Sure, the depth of what I feel for her is scary as shit, but that's actually a blessing when it boils down to it. Framing her face in my hands, I dip down closer to her. You're the solution. She blinks.
Pardon?
You were the solution to my problems, I say. Suddenly, it just makes so much sense now that she's the one standing before me needing support. First as my counselor, then later as my partner and lover, you gave me the strength I needed to push past my own fears. Nora shakes her head, a wry smile on her face.
That was all you, Tacker. I was just a sounding board.
It was you, I say with a shake of my head. You're my truth, Nora, and I'm fucking dazzled by it, You risked everything for me. Risked your career to give us a shot. You went into this knowing I have the real capacity to hurt you because of my issues, yet you weren't deterred. You're the strongest and bravest person I know. You make me want to be a better man. It's because of you that I'm a better person today. Nora's lower lip trembles, the magnitude of what I'm saying starting to sink in. You are everything to me, Nora, I say, taking her hands in mine. Everything I need in this life. I can't wrap my head around it just yet, the whys of the plane crash and for what possible reason MJ died, but I think part of that answer lies in the fact you and I are supposed to be together. I fucking hate saying that, and I pray to God MJ forgives me those thoughts. I'll have to check in with Dr. Dumfries for sure on that bit of mindfuck. But yes, you are meant for me. You're mine, and I'm yours. I'm positive of it. And even though it scares the fuck out of me over the prospect of losing you, and it causes me actual pain to see you in pain, I would not have it any other way. I wouldn't want one single thing to be different. We stare at each other for a moment, the rest of the emergency room fading away. What I'm trying to say, I say softly, is that I'm in love with you. Crazy, apeshit, head over heels in love with you. It's scary and comforting all at once, and I'm never giving it up. And I know this is probably the most awful, inopportune time to be having this discussion because we need to worry about Raoul and... Nora launches herself at me, arms around my neck, legs around my waist, and her mouth fastened onto mine. I actually stumble from the weight of emotion I can feel between us, but it's in her kiss that I can tell exactly how what I said makes her feel. The kiss is the sweetest and most explosive we've ever shared. Within it are 1,000 words we don't really have time to speak right now. That's okay. We have a lifetime. Nora's mouth leaves mine. Her eyes are closed as if she's trying to relish the last bit of what we just shared. When they flutter open and lock onto me, her lips curve ever so slightly.
I love you too.
Miss Wayne?
Comes from behind us. We turn and see a young female doctor searching for someone to claim the name. I let Nora slide to the ground, then take her hand in mine.
Right here,
Nora says, and the doctor waves us over to her.
I'm Dr. Mohan,
she says as she shakes Nora's hand. I'm then introduced as her boyfriend.
If you'll both follow me, I'll take you back to Mr. Vargas,
the doctor says, guiding us through the double doors. She talks over her shoulder as we traverse the hallways.
Based on the EKG, it appears Mr. Vargas had a heart attack, so we're scheduling him for an angiogram to check his arteries. But for right now, we do have him stabilized.
Nora's hand reflexively squeezes mine, and I respond in kind. Even though the woman just told me she loved me, which is about the best thing a man such as myself could ever want, I have to admit, it's much better hearing that Raoul is holding his own right now.
So he's conscious?
Nora asks.
He is,
Dr. Mohan replies.
And a little cantankerous.
My own heart is admittedly beating incredibly fast because I'm worried about Raoul. A heart attack is some serious shit, and I think there are some rough days ahead. But I have to believe if he's acting cantankerous in the emergency room after collapsing and needing CPR, then he must have a lot of kick still left in him.
Chapter 32. Nora. Glaring at that food won't make it disappear, I tell Raoul, as he glares at the tray in front of him. Want me to cut it up and feed it to you?
What I want is some huevos rancheros, he mutters, taking his spoon and poking it at his oatmeal.
Not gonna happen, I reply, settling into the vinyl-covered recliner in the corner of his hospital room. Hopefully he'll go home tomorrow. I sure will be thankful to get out of this chair, which I slept in the last two nights. It's been murder on my back. In fact, I continue, as I hold my phone up for him to see, I'm researching all kinds of new heart-healthy meals to make for you when we get you home.
Not changing my eating habits, he grouses.
You will, I say firmly, or you won't have a job at Sherem Ranch anymore. Raul glares, but I ignore him. Yes, he's extremely cantankerous when he's not feeling well. Thankfully, he's going to be okay. Well, as okay as someone who had a mild heart attack can be. It turns out he had a partially blocked artery. They were able to insert a stent to open it up, and he's expected to recover. Raul seems to think he'll be returning right to work as soon as he gets home, but that's a fight I'll have with him later. As it stands, Tacker argued with him yesterday until he was blue in the face about it, but to no avail. Raul was being too stubborn to see reason. Good thing I'm the boss. While I love the man like my own father, and he loves me in return just as deeply, when it boils down to it, I'll pull rank if I have to. I'm not about to lose him just yet. He needs to give himself time to recover so this doesn't happen again. And he's going to start eating better. End of story. But losing Raul at the ranch, even if temporarily, is a problem. I've had to reschedule riding lessons and hire temporary help for the horses. But I can't keep that up forever. My business barely ekes into the black each month, and there's no way I'm cutting Raul from the payroll.
If you need to replace me, Raul starts, and I jerk my focus from the grilled chicken and artichokes recipe I'd been perusing to him. I'd understand. You know that, right?
Was he just freaking reading my mind? I school my expression, but my exasperation bleeds through. Please! You just said you're coming right back to work.
Nora, he chides, his deep brown eyes solemn. I'm an old man. You have a young business. I would understand if you had to do what you had.
Just be quiet, I snap. Or I'm going to call Mary Beth Henson to come and watch over you this afternoon while I go feed the horses. A slight tinge of fear seeps into Raul's expression. She showed up yesterday with a bag of knitting, then promptly sat in one of the other guest chairs and glared at Raul the entire time, almost daring him to get sicker. It was hilarious, and Raul had been on his best behavior. I still have no clue why she showed up. She's shown nothing but disdain for him in the past. Tacker and I laughed about it later, while we ate dinner in the hospital cafeteria. He thinks Mary Beth is actually sweet on Raul, but doesn't know how to act and resorts to her normal crusty personality. I don't know how I would have made it these last few days without Tacker's support. From the moment he showed up in the emergency room, I could feel about 100 pounds of weight coming off me. I felt horribly guilty for pulling on him for support, because I was fearful it would be too much for him to bear. He's had so much on his shoulders for so long, and I didn't want to add more. Turns out, his shoulders are mighty fucking strong. And he loves me.
What are you smiling about now?
Raul asks. I blush from my toes to the roots of my hair, knowing he must have seen the physical effect on me as I thought about Tacker's beautiful speech. I still can't believe it. The depth of my feelings for him and, well, more unbelievable, how deeply he feels for me. Such a brave, fearless man to put himself out there again, open himself up to hurt and disappointment by taking a chance on me. Not sure I can really describe how that makes me feel, but it's akin to perhaps being able to conquer the world. His strength gives me strength, and I hope he feels that back from me. There's a knock on the door. All I see are a variety of spring blooms,
before I realize Tacker is standing behind them. I pop out of my chair, exclaiming with surprise, "What are you doing here?" He's not supposed to be here at all. He's supposed to be getting ready for the first home game of the playoffs tonight. Sadly, I won't be there, as it's just more important for me to stay here with Raul tonight. This despite protests from Raul that he didn't need me hovering. Tacker was more understanding, and he supports my decision to hover. He steps into the room, rounds the end of Raul's bed, and presses a kiss to my mouth.
"Just wanted to come by for a very quick visit. I can't stay but a few minutes."
He drove over 30 minutes on a playoff game day just to visit for a few minutes? Yes, I do love this man. My love only gets stronger by the minute, or so it seems.
"You didn't need to bring me flowers," Raul deadpans. "Not for you, old man," Tacker replies with a grin as he hands them to me. "For this beautiful lady, for having to put up with you the last few days."
I accept the flowers, put my nose in them, and inhale. Raising my eyes, I smile. "Thank you."
"Anything for you,"
he murmurs, dipping his head for another kiss. Raul makes a gagging sound, which means he's feeling better. Chuckling, Tacker pulls back from me and holds up a white bag with grease stains.
"And I brought you breakfast, chorizo and egg sandwiches."
Raul's eyes light up, as if he had just been handed a lottery ticket. I immediately squash his dreams by grabbing the bag from Tacker and telling Raul, "Sorry, not on the approved diet."
"You're killing me, Nora,"
Raul grumbles. "I'm saving you," I say. We engage in a staring contest. Eventually, Raul scoops up some oatmeal and puts it in his mouth, grimacing the entire time he chews.
"Hey,"
Tacker says, taking my upper arm.
"Mind if I talk to you out in the hall?"
"Sure," I reply, setting the flowers on my vacated chair. I keep the food bag in hand, not trusting Raul. Tacker walks up to Raul's bed, bends, and touches his shoulder.
"You doing good?"
"I'm good," Raul replies. "Don't you worry about me. And I'll be watching you tonight on the TV. Both Nora and I will."
"Thanks,"
Tacker replies, giving him an affectionate squeeze. Then he drops his voice.
"And I'll sneak you some better food next time when she's not watching."
"I heard that," I say in a sing-song voice. When the men smile at each other, it warms my heart to see the affection Raul truly has for Tacker and vice versa. When Tacker and I reach the hall and I pull the door shut behind me, I'm shocked to find him laying a hard kiss on me. While I can understand him wanting some privacy from Raul to kiss me, he doesn't seem to mind that the nurse's station is right behind us.
You taste good,"
he murmurs when his lips leave mine. My whole body wants to melt into his. We haven't been together in an intimate way since Raul collapsed, and exchanging sentiments of love and devotion only makes me want this man more.
"But that's not really what I wanted to do out here,"
he continues. "What did you want to do?" I ask curiously.
"I wanted to give you this,"
he replies, then pulls something out of his back pocket. I take it from him, unfold it, and realize it's a certified check made out to Sharam Ranch for $20,000. My eyes snap to his. "What's this for?"
"It's to help you and Raul out for the short term. All the guys on the team chipped in money. If you need to hire someone to help out for a bit, or Raul needs anything, it's basically to help however necessary. Bishop organized it."
As I stare at the paper, my heart fills to near bursting over not just the generosity of Tacker's teammates, but also over the fact they even thought to do something for us.
"And whatever else you need past that," Tacker continues,
moving in a little closer to me. He tucks a stray piece of hair behind my ear.
You come to me for it. I've got you covered until Raoul and the ranch can get back on its feet, so to speak.
You don't have to.
I've got you covered, Nora.
His expression is fierce, determined. He's not to be argued with.
Whatever you need, financial help, emotional support, dozens of orgasms to help you relax, you come to me.
Got it, I reply, a dopey smile on my face.
Especially the part about orgasms, he says with a mock glare.
Only you for that, I agree with a sharp nod.
For any of it, he says, pulling me into his arms. I love you. I've got your back. You don't have to face anything alone.
I love you too, I say, going to my tiptoes to kiss him again. And I'm so thankful you're in my life.
Here to stay,
he says, before bringing his lips to my forehead for a sweet kiss of affirmation.
Except now, I have to go.
Tacker takes a step back, lets his eyes roam over my face, and decides to come back in for one more kiss. It's a good one, too. Then he's backing away, this time for good. Pivoting on his heel, he saunters down the hallway, like he doesn't have a care in the world, despite having a particularly important game tonight. He walks like a man so fucking happy with his life. And that is all I ever want for him.
Girl,
someone drawls, and I glance over at the nurse's station to see three hanging on the counter. Two stare after Tacker, and one is looking right at me.
You are one lucky woman.
I glance at my man, completely oblivious to being ogled, and then grin at the nurses. Don't I know it? Bonus scene. Nora.
Mary Beth's leaving,
Tacker says as he peers out the front window of my house. I snicker, looking up from the book I've been reading on my Kindle. Turns out Mary Beth is sweet on Raoul, and Raoul's not as averse to her as he's been proclaiming. She's been over at his house every day since he came home from the hospital 3 days ago. Tacker turns to face me, gaze going to the digital reader in my hands.
Good book?
I shrug. Just a way to pass time, until you finally get up the courage to tell me whatever it is you're wanting to tell me. The smile I get is sheepish as he saunters over to me.
You know me too well.
Dropping down onto the couch beside me, Tacker reaches over and pulls me onto his lap, so I'm facing him. I'm straddling those powerful legs and is even more powerful. Well, you know, under me. But this isn't that type of face-to-face. I can tell when something's weighing on him, and he clearly wants to talk about it.
So I did a thing,
he starts off by saying, his hands coming to rest on my thighs.
And it's kind of like when I made the Shendetli for your birthday. And I wasn't sure if I was overstepping my bounds.
You weren't, I reassure him. I don't think you could overstep with me. I trust you implicitly. A measure of relief filters into his expression.
So, I asked Willow if she'd check into where your family is buried when she was over in Kosovo.
Now this catches me off guard. It's probably the last subject matter I'd expect him to bring up. But I'm not bothered by it, merely curious. What for?
I had thought,
he starts hesitantly, and I can hear the doubt in his tone that he's still not sure if this was a cool thing to do or not.
That if you wanted to have them moved here to the cemetery on the ranch, we could do that.
Oh, I murmur, my gaze dropping to his chest. It's a great chest. I've laid against it many, many times as I listened to his beautiful heart beating.
That was a bad idea, huh?
I snap my head up, shaking it with vigor. No,
Not at all. It just caught me by surprise. I'd never even considered that would be a possibility.
I did a little more than just find out where they were, he continues, still with that same tentative tone, as if he's not sure how this will impact me. I actually sort of have it all arranged, if you want to bring them over. You just have to give me the word.
The enormity of what he's done hits me all at once. I flop forward onto that massive, comforting chest that is now mine. Tacker's arms come around me. It's too much, I say. I can't let you do that, the cost alone.
I can afford it, he points out.
That's beside the point, I return dryly.
No, it's exactly the point, he replies.
Then he's pushing me off his chest so he can look me in the face.
I love doing things for you, Nora, and this isn't about money. It's about me doing something that can help you in your journey. After everything you've done for me, for the way you loved me, let me do this for you.
I stare at his beautiful face, a mere echo of the beautiful soul within him. He regards me with such naked love, I couldn't deny him even if I wanted to, which I don't. How did I ever get so lucky to have you? I ask, which gives him my answer. I'll gladly accept.
Pretty sure I'm the lucky one, he chuckles.
I lean in, and we kiss, sweet and fulfilling. Later, when we're naked, it will be just as fulfilling, but a lot less sweet. Completely amazing and rapturous. This man pushes every one of my buttons in just the right way. Kind and generous, open and transparent. He's been through hell and back, and it landed him right on my doorstep. I never helped put his broken pieces together. He did that all himself. I'm just thankful that when he was complete again, he happened to be staring in my direction and was willing to let me continue on his journey by his side. I can't wait to see where we go.
This has been Tacker, Book 5 of the Arizona Vengeance series. Written by Sawyer Bennett. Narrated by Stephen Dexter and Lucy Rivers. Copyright 2019 by Sawyer Bennett. Production copyright 2019 by Sawyer Bennett. Production coordination by Lyric Audiobooks. Producer Kim Gilmore. Post-production by Eric Sinistvet. Stephen Dexter and Lucy Rivers are members of SAG-AFTRA. For more information about author Sawyer Bennett or any other title in the Arizona Vengeance series, please visit www.sawyerbennett.com.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.